Okay, so what I want to do today is to go a little bit further in modulation, demodulation, and show you how real radios work. We have a couple pictures here of some really state-of-the-art radios. And then we'll spend some time reviewing for the first exam, just talking about what topics you've covered and things. And hopefully by the end of the class, you'll feel pretty good about how much we've covered and how much you've learned in the first part of the course. Is it amazing? The course is one-third over already.
Yeah.
I know for you guys, you're probably happy about that, but courses go by so quickly these days.
That's it.
Yeah, we had an exam on Monday, and I think you had a pretty good problem-solving session last night. So. I'm not seeing anybody. No?
No,
I heard there were like 23 people there.
I heard they were turning people back in the door. I tried to get in and they said no.
Okay, well, I'll just delude myself into thinking that all the things Hal told me were true. Okay, so let's talk a couple slides on how real radios work. So we talked last time about this is how essentially a model of the electromagnetic spectrum. You've got all these radio stations and other things floating around, TV stations, and they're all multiplexed together to use the same airspace. So what you get out here is something like this, and now we have to demodulate this thing somehow. Now, building a receiver that's unique for every radio, every station, every piece of information that you want could get very expensive. So we need a way to do this that's a little more efficient. So welcome to the FCC, your friend. So recall and recover one channel from this multiplex signal that has all the channels. When you hang your antenna out the window or whatever, you pick up all the radio stations, and we need to focus on one of those. So we must first bandpass filter the multiplex signal. If we don't do that, that's something I didn't stress last class. If we don't bandpass filter this signal, what happens if we try to demodulate this signal at a particular frequency? Well, all this stuff is going to come down into baseband. We're going to have a mess. So we have to pick out only the station that we're interested in and then demodulate that. What?
The PDF files of bars.
No, it's the when you link images, all the images are linked to the sources, so I don't get into copyright trouble. So, but then when you click on the PowerPoint, it wants to go there, so kind of annoying. So, what we're going to do is to bandpass filter the input and pick up only the frequency range of interest. And then we're going to demodulate that down to baseband and then low-pass filter it. But as we talked about last time, when you do this, you better only get one station. So the channels must not overlap for this to work. And this is an important role played by the FCC. It manages the electromagnetic spectrum and so that you're the only one broadcasting in the range that you've been given. However, to do this is expensive because you need a highly selective bandpass filter with a tunable center frequency. Now, some of you might have been in the lab trying to build those things, right? And is that a fairly easy thing to do, to build a really sharp filter that's tunable?
No, it's annoying.
It's really annoying, right? You have all sorts of tolerances of components and things to worry about, or you can build active filters and whatnot, but it's kind of difficult. And believe me, it was a lot more difficult when radios looked like they did on the front page, when you had tubes and things. So what was invented many, many years ago is a principle called the super heterodyne receiver. And the idea here is simple. Down-convert all the channels to a common intermediate frequency. Do this to a common intermediate frequency, and then take the rest, the back end of the radio then essentially can be fixed and go from that common frequency to baseband. So the advantage of this method is that most of the radio signals path has to be sensitive to only a narrow range of frequencies. Only the front end, the part before the frequency converter, needs to be sensitive to a wide range of frequency. And there's a link to a wiki page which has a nice detailed explanation of this. So this is what the super heterodyne receiver looks like, and this is how radios were built in the days when we had tubes. And then because that became a standard, they continued down this path for quite a while. So we have, for example, the AM band, which extends from 535 kilohertz to 1,605 kilohertz. And the FCC mandates this intermediate frequency. All radios use this same intermediate frequency of 455 kilohertz. So the way the radio works, you have the signal come in, you have a coarse tunable filter. This is essentially the tuning knob on your radio that's going to down convert this signal to a fixed frequency, this IF frequency. And then from here back, you have essentially the process of converting from the IF frequency down to baseband. So the way this works is that essentially everything other than the band of interest is rejected, and that's done using this coarse tunable filter. This does not have to be super sharp. The FCC controls how much overlap there is between the stations, and initially that was chosen so that you could build fairly inexpensive filters like this. Now, as more and more technology came online, and as more and more broadcasters wanted to use the electromagnetic spectrum, the distance between stations started to shrink a little bit. And as we talked about last time, with one of the great things about the move to digital is that they're actually packing the stations closer together with the digital technology. So they're getting more stations within the same amount of bandwidth. So the principle is to down-convert the received signal from the actual modulation frequency that it was set at. This would be, for example, 1600 kilohertz for AM station, to this intermediate frequency of 455 kilohertz, and then use a sharp fixed bandpass filter at this intermediate frequency to demodulate the remaining signal and remove the remnants of the other channels attached to the coarse filter. So by doing a coarse filter here and then a sharp fixed filter here, you save the difficulty and the expense of building a sharp filter here. So this is simply an engineering trade-off, but it's a trade-off that was very attractive given the state of electronics at the time, long before integrated circuits and things. Now today, I think that's actually the last slide on this. So today, of course, with digital technology now, we're starting to see all what are called software radios, radios that are essentially all digital. Sampling, software, and out comes your audio. And that's one of the neat things about the movement towards digital, is that you can implement a lot of different radios or demodulators in the same piece of hardware, because it's all basically being done in software. So what's called the software-defined radios is really a hot topic now, because more and more you're finding devices able to handle many different kinds of signals. One of the most common examples of this are the cell phones. There's a push towards cell phones that can work anywhere in the world, and they do that by simply sensing the modulation that's being used. You know, why can't there be the same modulation throughout the whole world? Well, you know, that's a political issue, but engineers have to come in behind that and build cell phones which sense what kind of modulation is being used and automatically load in the software that demodulates for that kind of modulation. And you're seeing these kinds of technologies more and more. You're also seeing multi-purpose devices that can accept TV signals, radio signals, all these kinds of things. And again, that once you're digital, that can easily be done just being done in software. So there's a lot of advantage to doing things digitally. And then as increasingly the transmissions themselves are becoming digital, so that the once you demodulate the analog signal and you get the baseband signal, you now have to decrypt that because it's somehow it's represented as a digital as digital information. And that's advantageous because typically you can get much higher quality and much much more reliable transmission, but the drawback is that you have to do a little bit more work on modulation to get the bandwidth to be about the same as the equivalent in analog. Probably the way things are going, more and more of the signals that you're seeing will become pure digital transmissions, whereas instead of analog transmissions. And an interesting contrast to all this, we talk about with AM and FM and things like this, that you don't want the signals to overlap in the spectrum. Well, if you go further in communications, you get to learn about things like spread spectrum, which actually work on the opposite principle. All signals are spread out across the same spectrum, and they all simultaneously use the same spectrum. But it's done in such a way that you can decrypt the signals because you have a digital key associated with each one of those signals. And spread spectrum is a really, it's been around for years, but it's really picked up steam in the last 10 years because you can go up very high in frequency, up into the multi-gigahertz range, and you can transmit many, many signals over the same channel. And that's one of the ways that wireless phones, at one time they thought wireless phones were going to work that way. They haven't quite made it that way yet, but cell phones also use a very interesting technique for sharing the same electromagnetic spectrum with multiple phones simultaneously. And you may remember the old analog phones, then we had the first digital phones, then we went to a couple generations of the digital phones. And within the digital phone technology, there's a couple competing standards and things like this. So all those kinds of things you get a chance to study in the communications class if you go that far. So that's end of the first part of the course. And what I thought I'd spend a few minutes today doing is going through what we've covered thus far and making you feel a little bit better about the exam on Monday. So are there any general questions? You have access to previous exams online, so you should walk into the class with a very good idea of what you're going to see. The exam will focus on the homework problems, so there's no mystery. If you know how to do all the homework problems, you should get a perfect score on the exam. Will we get a perfect score on the exam? No, the class average on this exam will probably be below 50. Don't ask me why, you know, but that's a reality. So when you take the exam, and for many of you, you'll find taking the exams on these kinds of problems difficult. So when that exam hits your desk, and you know, everyone goes through some kind of freeze, you start reading the problems, and it looks like it's written in Japanese or something, and just take a deep breath and remember, the class average is going to be below 50, so don't worry if you don't get every problem right. Just try to do the things you do correctly. Choose your battles carefully and spend time on the things you know how to do, and don't stress out about the things you don't know how to do.
You kind of smile after you say class average.
Yeah, I'm very proud of the fact that I gave a final exam in this course many years ago where the class average was below 10. I was really proud of that. I also gave an exam. No, I was very proud of that. It was one of my greatest accomplishments as a teacher.
You submitted that on tape.
It's now those were the days when students would challenge me to think up interesting and creative problems. So of course I was very proud of the exams because they were a lot of interesting problems on them. And you can look back through the previous exams and see some of those. Another thing we did one year was that after a few of the exams, the students were convinced that if they were allowed to sort of choose the topics for the problems, they could do better. So I let them pick the topics for the problems. And one of the topics they chose was donuts, because we were making up a class. That particular lecture, I was making up a class early in the morning, so I brought donuts because we had like a 7 o'clock lecture. And they challenged me. They said, you can't make up a signals and systems problem on donuts. So they thought this was safe because, you know, what could I ask them? Well, they got a very interesting problem on donuts. And it was hilarious when that test hit the desks and people saw the picture of the donut on the front page of the problem. You know, it was just hilarious because they were like, oh, God.
what kind of signals and system question can you ask about a donut? I'm not going to
say. Well,
the
question I was actually very, it's one of my, one of my proudest questions.
So when they, crowning achievements.
Yes, it was because it had to be about the box of donuts that I brought. And the box of donuts, the donuts were, Dunkin' Donuts, like Food Max Donuts, I think they got them. So, we had a picture. We had a two pictures. So first, you know, they get the exam hits their desk, they open it up, and here's two pictures of donuts. This is a glazed donut. So, you know, it's nice and shiny and smooth. And this is a donut with multicolored sprinkles. And the question was actually very simple. Compare and contrast the frequency responses of these two images. And this is why my class averages used to be below 10 on exams. Now, it's actually a very good question.
Were the sprinkles colored?
Yeah, these were actually colored.
Okay.
But no one got that far. I mean, even if they were just solid chocolate sprinkles, I would have been happy. But the thing about this question was, we have a lot of what seem like informal discussions in class. And I know you think that, you know, I'm just BSing you, but most of these discussions have a point to them. And I try to guide them in a direction where they have a point. What's one of the things I've tried to hit home on about frequency response? What's the difference between a low pass, a signal that has low frequency content, and a signal that has high frequency content?
Time domain representation.
Well, what causes high frequency content in a signal?
Sharp
changes, right? So that's point number one that you needed. And I talk about this a lot throughout the course. So sharp changes translate to high frequencies. Now, another thing that we've talked about this semester is that frequency response is not something restricted to a one-dimensional signal, like audio. You can have a two-dimensional, three-dimensional, four-dimensional signal, but the principle is the same. So, let's assume for the moment that this glazed donut, because it doesn't have any real sharp changes, what's the general frequency response of that donut going to look like if you had to draw it? Well, how many, let's go after simple things. And this is the way you should approach problems. Break them down into, you know, things you know and sort of chip away at the solution. A one-dimensional signal, when we plot the frequency response of that signal, if we plot that in how many dimensions?
Two.
We have magnitude and phase, or, you know, it's complex, but let's just talk magnitude as a function of frequency. So how many dimensions does this picture have?
Three. It's an image.
It's an image, so it's actually three is a good answer. It's got x and y, or distance in two directions, space, and then amplitude. So what is its magnitude spectrum? How many dimensions is it going to take to plot its magnitude spectrum?
Three.
So the picture is going to have to be something like this. Now, if we think about just a particular direction along this picture, if I just sort of draw a line through this picture and ask what's the frequency response of the signal along that line, is it going to change as I rotate that line? No, right? It's got to be kind of symmetric, circular. Okay, so the picture, so look, we've already figured out quite a lot about the frequency response. It's got to be kind of circularly shaped. And we also said, well, sharp changes have high frequency, so the glazed donut is smooth. So what kind of frequency response is it going to have? To have a low-pass frequency response. So if you think about this enough, you'll draw a picture that looks something like the Gaussian or something that, you know, looks like that.
So.
All right, so now you're halfway home already. Just using, you know, a couple basic concepts. Now, what about the sprinkle donut?
It's going to be sharp changes.
How does this have to differ from this, and why?
Sprinkles are going to cause sharp changes where they're cut off, where they're spaced.
So it's going to start low and come up high.
Well, so all I was really looking for was for someone to say that this one's going to have higher frequency. It's still going to roughly be circularly symmetric, but its bandwidth has to be larger because these sprinkles are going to cause more high frequency energy. Hold on, an easy 25 points.
No.
So you're asking that again?
No, that will not be on this exam. But on the final, we'll have some fun, because on the final, I get you're going to use MATLAB, and I'm not constrained to just giving you homework problems. But you'll have three exams to get up to that point. So,
do the sprinkles cause frequency content because they're not like continuous with what surrounds them?
So what happens if you just draw a line through this picture and you think about the amplitude of the grayscale, if you will, or the color as a function of this along this line?
I mean, it would be.
What's going to happen when you hit these sprinkles?
It'd be non-continuous. It would have like
frequency going to increase.
Right, you're going to get, you know, this kind of stuff. You have like every time you hit a sprinkle, you're going to get some, you know, something like that. So when you hit these kinds of things, what does that cause in the frequency domain? Well, that causes high frequency content. Now, if you really want to get into this, you could argue, well, as you rotate this line, the sprinkles are not uniform.
Right.
But on the average, actually, they may very well be if someone's done a good job of assembling that donut. The ones I get, I can tell you're not circularly symmetric, but that's a whole other story.
You have to go to Tuscaloosa for one of those.
Plus, so they're delicious.
If you had chocolate sprinkles, would it really change the frequency response from the glaze all that much?
It's the color.
Yeah, so let's start with something simple, chocolate sprinkles. Same color, but still what's going to happen every time you hit a chocolate sprinkle, because let's assume that now if the donut's chocolate, now we can get into the details, right? So chocolate donut with chocolate sprinkles versus white donut with chocolate sprinkles. Which is going to have more high frequency content?
Which is more delicious?
The chocolate one?
No.
The white one with chocolate.
White ones. You're going to have the white to chocolate transition.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just hungry.
What about the...
Now, what about white donut with chocolate sprinkles versus white donut with colored sprinkles? Now, that's a little bit harder.
I guess it would depend on the sprinkle, really.
The deliciousness.
Like, wouldn't you just add another dimension?
So I didn't expect them to go. These were actually black and white pictures because I didn't want to get into the issue of color. Color is actually represented in its own three-dimensional space. And with color, you can actually have transforms for each one of the colors. Break the signal down into a...
That's what I thought you were asking about, was like the spectrum of like the color. The frequency response is, you know, red, green, blue.
But even if you didn't get this, if someone gave me a really nice, interesting, coherent discussion that showed they really understood some of these concepts, I was happy to give them good credit. But of course, what really happens on a problem like this is students freak out and then they leave it blank. Don't leave your paper blank. Write some basic knowledge about the problem, write a few equations that you think are relevant to the problem. Leaving something blank just makes it very easy for me to grade because I can just give you a zero.
Draw a few donuts.
What?
Don't draw donuts.
It's not a problem about donuts. But there is an art to maximizing your score on exams, even though you don't know how to work any of the problems.
I'm like Warren, man.
Do you get bonus points for
every day?
What?
Do you get bonus points for gloriously wrong?
Yes. I've had people give me really powerfully wrong arguments. And I give them credit for it because it shows that they're able to invoke a lot of these concepts. Now, I mean within reason, if you start writing completely off the topic, no. But you get a
treating some Spanish on my business.
Yeah, it's like in 1492.
I had someone do that actually. On my last final exam, I gave a question. You can look at it, it's online. It was something about. It was global warming. I said, your job was, you're the now President Bush's chief scientist, and you've been asked to give a talk on global warming. Explain sort of the challenges of making a definitive statement about global warming, because if you follow the whole global warming thing, there's a big debate about whether this is just some 500-year or 3 million-year cycle, or whether this is truly due to the events to industry and carbon and all that in the last 50 years. And there's a lot of signal processing issues in making that call. And there's still a lot of debate about whether we're actually seeing true global warming or whether this is just the inverse of an ice age. So one of the students who actually was a Toastmasters and did a lot of community service and organizations gave me an answer. It was total BS, but he did it really creatively, and he actually wrote the speech out that he would give, and it was a very well-written speech, and I gave him a lot of credit for that, because, you know, I could see him up there, you know, BSing away and being very successful at it, and saying, that's my signals and systems student there. So anyway, there's another. Now, don't totally BS me. I mean, I can see through the BS. But when you try to work problems, even if you don't know how to work them. So another thing quickly about problem solving, since I feel like, you know, this isn't taught as much in schools as it used to. When you're given a word problem, what's the first thing that you do?
Read it.
Read it. So when you're given an exam, what's the first thing that you do?
Write
your name down, and then what? Well, someone will want to write their name after their.
Read the directions.
Yeah, all that, and then what?
Find some I can definitely work.
Read all the problems. Take a deep breath. Half the class is going to start writing furiously. Somehow that triggers an emotional response to start writing furiously. Don't. If when I put the exams down, if I didn't see any writing for the first 5 minutes, I'd actually be very happy. Read the exam. Look at all the problems, and look at them and say, which ones do I know how to work, which ones I don't know how to work. And then in your mind, set up a schedule of, okay, I'm going to try to spend so many minutes on the ones I know, and then I'm going to spend most of my time on the ones I don't know. But you get the ones you know done first. That'll warm you up. That'll relax you. It's amazing how much, you know, you'll be thinking about the other problems and things will start clicking because your confidence will be a little higher after you've worked some things correctly. So one of the things I used to do is always make sure the first problem on the exam was the hardest, because I knew most of the students were going to start working the first problem first, and they're just shooting themselves in the foot. And they run out of time on the easy parts, which are, you know, the later problems. Okay, so you've now decided which problem you're going to work. What's the next thing that you do if you've never seen this problem before?
See what you're given.
What?
See what you're given already.
Okay, so how do you do that?
Read the problem.
Well, you read the problem, but then what?
You pick out values that are important to solving the problem given to you.
So expand on that when you say pick out values.
You find relevant information is, I think, the way they usually say it. Like, you could tell us, like, I don't know, analyze the frequency response, and also McDonald's is 5 feet away from your house. And it's like, okay, well, cool.
So, the first thing that you do is make sure that you understand every piece of information given to you and how that might fit into the solution or how that might be irrelevant to the solution. It's really important to do that, because in doing that, you're going to figure out sort of what the equation, you know, there's the left-hand side of the equation, what you're trying to find, and there's all the stuff on the right-hand side. And you're going to figure out what are the missing pieces of information. And usually then, once you know the missing pieces of information and you understand all the data that you're given, you'll say, oh, okay, he wants me to find this piece from this information. So you'll understand now the second level of equations. And usually most exam problems are only two levels deep. You calculate some intermediate variables, and then you plug those into the final equation. So that's a good way to earn partial credit, because by showing all that work of understanding the information, understanding what topics may apply to this problem, you're showing me that you're doing some relevant work towards a solution to that problem. Do people do that? No. They scribble here, scribble there, and leave the problem mostly blank when they don't know how to do it. And that's unfortunate. So, try to attack these problems in a very systematic way. And if you get stuck, it's fine to write on the I'm very generous with partial credit, I guess you could say, but write a couple sentences that say, I think I need to calculate such and such, but I don't really understand how to do that. And that shows that you got most of the way through the problem and you just got hung up. If you think some key piece of information is missing, ask a question. I really like it when students ask questions during the exam. So sometimes if you ask a question, I'll give that all information to the whole class because it's kind of a relevant insight into a problem. So don't be afraid to ask questions during the exam. What?
What is the answer?
You already know the answers because you've seen the problems. In this case, it's how you get the answer.
Would you mind providing the solution?
Now, you've looked at some of the solutions, right? I hope by now. The solutions are really not very informative, right?
Right.
So just writing the answers is not going to get you any credit. And making up something and then writing the answer where the two are not connected is not going to get you much credit either. It's only going to get me angry. But the point of is to show me how to solve the problems, not to get the specific answer. Okay. Any questions? If you think you're missing a key equation, integral, or whatever, ask me and I'll probably give it to you. I don't hold you responsible for memorization of those kinds of things.
There are those really large tables for like properties of the Fourier transform.
Right, I'll provide. I can provide those. There's a couple PDF files on the website from I did that last semester. People asked that, so I'll on the overhead here. I'll put the I'll provide those tables.
Okay. So we don't have to write
them. Can you shoot us an email and tell us which ones you're going to give us so we know?
I will.
Okay.
Somebody send me an email to remind me of that if I don't do it, but there's a PDF file called underscore tables on the website that has all that. Okay. I don't know, remember if I did it for the first exam, but I know with the subsequent exams I did, and I'll use that same document. Okay? So we've had essentially 13 lectures for this exam, so I wanted to go through and just highlight things that we've learned. Hopefully that we've learned. Things I've talked about, certainly. basic properties of signals, that was our first lecture. And I'm just going to sort of read through the topics, but hopefully as I'm reading through these, in the back of the mind you're saying, yeah, I know what that is, or I'm not so sure what that is. If you're not sure, ask me a question and we can talk about it a little bit. So continuous signals which are continuous as a function of time and amplitude, discrete time signals, continuous in amplitude but discrete in time, digital signals. What's the difference between digital signals and those other two signals? How would you describe a digital signal?
Digital signal is a discrete time signal that is also discrete amplitude.
Amplitude, very good. That's what we call a digital signal. Real and complex signals. What's a common complex signal that we've been using so far?
AC circuits, like impedance?
No.
Okay.
Well,
what's a mathematical function that's a complex? It's a complex function. Its value is complex as a function of time.
E to the j omega t.
You've been making a lot of use of that function. It forms the basis of the Fourier series and the Fourier transform. Properties of signals. Give me an example of an even signal.
Cosine.
Even means f of t is equal to f of minus t. Give me an example of an odd signal.
Sine.
F of t is equal to f of minus f of minus t. What about periodic signal? Why are periodic signals so important?
Because you can actually make Fourier series.
We represent them as Fourier series. What kind of spectrum do they have?
Straight lines.
Line spectrum.
Multiples of the.
Multiples of the fundamental frequency. What's a common example of a periodic signal? Okay, what about in the real world?
60 hertz
sine wave.
Question.
Yeah.
So is an aperiodic signal still continuous?
Yes. Now, that could get weak if the signal has a. We haven't talked yet about random signals, but you can have some interesting phenomena with what are called non-stationary signals, signals that change their properties as a function of time. And the theory of chaos and things like that deal with that. So you could actually have a signal that suddenly changes in amplitude because it's changed state.
Like a pendulum on a pendulum?
No, a pendulum would still be continuous.
I mean a pendulum on a pendulum.
Second one.
Pendulum on a pendulum.
No, it would still be continuous.
I think that since that's a physical system, it would still be continuous. But like if you're looking at a voltage on your computer screen, like a pixel, as a function of time, you can make that change abruptly because you change programs or something. And that would be an example of a discontinuous signal. But signals in the real world are actually continuous, but we don't need to get too philosophical on this exam. So then we talk about properties of signals. Impulse function, unit step function, the ramp function. What's the relationship between the impulse, the unit step, and the ramp?
Integral, or
exactly. We talked about time shift is equivalent to what in the frequency domain?
Phase shift.
Time shift and phase shift. This is duality. We talked about continuous, piecewise continuous. We talked about derivatives. We talked about sampling. Then we talked about system properties. Causality, linearity, and time invariance. Causality. Explain causality in the context of the stock market.
An event occurs now and affects an event in the future.
And not the other way around.
No. Or
it's a big puzzle. Like we can't look ahead in the stock market. So that's
Right. If you could condition your decisions today on information tomorrow, you could make a lot of money in the stock market. And that's essentially what people try to do in the stock market. But of course, in the real world, we can't know what's going to happen in the future. So causality says a system can only dependent on now or things in the past. So for a differential equation, that means things like derivatives of x of t, x and so forth. For a discrete time system, that means things like x of n minus t versus x of n plus t. And it's very common to have digital systems which are, in some sense, non-causal because we can just write that in software. We can look ahead in a buffer in software. But you can't look ahead in an electric circuit. At least we haven't figured out how to do that yet. Linearity. Give me an example of a nonlinear system that you use every day.
Radio.
What's nonlinear about a radio?
Volume.
The way voltage varies as a function of the volume control on your radio is a nonlinear relationship. How do you know? If I give you a black box and I tell you it's nonlinear, or prove to me that it's nonlinear, what might you try to do?
Map the output and the voltage.
Okay. So what? But it's possible that it's actually possible that the output voltage varies linearly with the input in the laboratory. And there, I won't say too much about that. But the system's still nonlinear. What's another example of a nonlinearity? And I had a little appendix or handout on this.
Clipping.
Well, clipping would be one, but you would see that by plotting the amplitude variation. You'd sit there with a source and raise the amplitude of the input and plot the output.
internal resistance, like build up and things in the real world, drop pulses, drops across wires and things.
If you put a sine wave into that system and it's nonlinear, what would you expect to see on the output?
An oscillation? You can see like a, you can see a sawtooth wave, you can see a,
it wouldn't be a straight.
So when a system is, so when you have a linear system and you apply a sine wave as input, let's say 60 hertz sine wave, what will you see at the output? 60 hertz sine wave. The amplitude will be a little different. The phase will be a little different, but it'll still be a 60 hertz sine wave. If the system has a non-linearity to it, like a transformer or something, what will you see when you look at the output? You might see clipping, but let's say you don't quite see clipping, but what are some of the other things you might see?
Changing frequency.
What about harmonics? Have you ever looked at the output of some of these power systems? You will have multiples of that fundamental frequency if the system has non-linearities. And I distributed a handout on this that talk about why this is, but essentially if the system has non-linearities, you get harmonics of that base frequency. So you can look in a spectrum analyzer, and if you're seeing energy at other harmonics, then you know the system's non-linear. Even for simple systems like transformers and things, you will see that.
Was that a paper handout, or was that, you know?
It was an appendix on one of the lectures. Time invariance. Is the stock market time invariant? What's an example of a time invariant system in the real world?
It's not one.
Very good. Why are most systems in the real world, if not all, time varying?
Degradation.
They wear out eventually. They age, they, you know, and all that. Okay, we talked a little bit about statistics. That won't really be on the exam, but we talked about how you can compute averages and variances and things like that. We'll come back to that later in the semester. Then we did convolution for both discrete time and continuous time. And I think, you know, these days that's a pretty well, we've covered that topic pretty well. You've got tools. You should be able to know how to graphically convolve two signals. And why do we use convolution? What's the main use of time domain convolution?
You can get the system out of its impulse response.
We can characterize a system by its impulse response, and then we can use that impulse response and convolution to compute the output to any input. So convolution is the principal way that we find output signals, given input signals for linear time invariant systems. We then went through differential equations, and this was one of the points where we began to relate what you're learning to circuits. So we talked about simple RC circuits and showed some properties of the impulse response and things like that, and showed that all of what we're learning about signals can be used to solve circuits. And really, the circuit analysis that you've learned thus far is a special case of what we're learning in this course. We then did continuous time convolution. We talked about Fourier series, which we use for periodic signals, complex and trigonometric Fourier series were the two main forms that we talked about. We talked a little bit about how its convergence, what types of signals it converges for, what types of signals it diverges for. And we talked about Gibbs phenomena, which is how we get convergence at discontinuities in the signal and the non-uniform nature of that convergence. So you get this overshoot and ringing at the edges of the pulse and that kind of thing. Then we talked about trigonometric Fourier series. We talked about even and odd symmetry. So even an odd symmetry is another good example. If I ask you to compute a Fourier series of a signal, the first thing you should look at is what is the symmetry in that signal? Is it an even signal? Is it an odd signal? And then you can tell me something about the answer without doing any calculations. And typically, you know, that kind of analysis will get you very far along in the problem. We then related the Fourier series to frequency spectrum. We talked about how you can take the plot of the Fourier series coefficients and interpret that as a line spectrum at real frequencies. Then we talked about the Fourier transform. When do we use Fourier transform?
Non-periodic signals.
For non-periodic signals, we actually generalized it to apply to periodic signals as well. But its principal use is for non-periodic signals. We talked about the Fourier transform of a pulse. We showed how you can use the Fourier transform to get the frequency response of a linear time-invariant system, and how you can compute the output given the Fourier transform of the impulse response and given the Fourier transform of the input. We talked about properties of Fourier transform. All these properties we'll see over and over through the semester. Most of the transforms we talk about will obey these properties. And then we talked about modulation and demodulation and superheader dime receivers. Those are in color because I won't really ask you about those on this exam. So the exam will end with Fourier transform properties. So that's what we covered. Now the question is, what did we really learn? So what was the first part of this course about?
Properties of signals.
So what are some of the major concepts we introduced this in the first part of the course? Well, we certainly talked about time domain versus frequency domain. We began in the time domain, we moved to the frequency domain, and we learned how you can relate behavior in the time domain to behavior in the frequency domain. We talked about discrete time versus continuous time, spent most of our time on continuous time signals, but we'll continue to work with discrete time signals as we introduce new concepts. And we talked about how these behave for a wide range of signals, including impulses, steps, ramps, sine waves, time-limited, infinite duration signals, and so forth. And we did all this in just the first third of the course. So there's a lot of stuff there. But if you really think about it, it all, you know, there's not, conceptually, there's a few major concepts and a lot of little details. And what we're after in this course is to make you really understand the general concepts. The details are not all that important. I mean, the being able to calculate some really complicated integral, that's not that important these days. But understanding the reasons we're introducing these concepts and how they can be related to the real world, that's what's important. That's what you'll use 20 years from now when you're a successful engineer building all sorts of really cool devices. And you'll have it all, you can look back and say, that's all because of my signals and systems class. So, you know, I hope when you're already beginning to get an appreciation of the fact that how practical this class is, even though students often think it's just a theoretical, abstract class. We use this technology to describe a lot of different things about the real world. And we did all sorts of MATLAB stuff in addition to this. So it's been a busy semester so far. And the good news is we go even faster for the next section of the class, because we build on top of all this. You're welcome. Okay. Mondays are not great times for exams, but we'll see how it goes.